John 9, verses 1 through 12. The title today is Before It Is Too Late. Verse 1. Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said to him, Go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Therefore, the neighbors of those who had previously had seen that he was blind said, Is this not he who sat and begged? Some said, This is he. Others said, He is like him. He said, I am he. Therefore, they said to him, How were your eyes opened? He answered and said, A man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and I received sight. Then they said to him, Where is he? He said, I do not know.
But we're in John chapter 9. I'm with you guys this week, and maybe I'm not supposed to tell you this, but I'm with you next week, and you're stuck with me again. So if you don't want to come back, then the doors are back there. But we're going to take a look at John chapter 9, and as I was reading this, I realized that if I had the time, if I had more Sundays, if you know I didn't need to get back to Cebu, I probably would have taken like 5 or 6 Sundays to get through that, but that is not an option. I've got 2. So we're going to go through this rather quickly, and you're going to see what I mean when I start reading this. There's a lot of ideas in here, and we don't have time to dig into all of them. However, the danger in trying to cover John chapter 9 is we have no clue what happened in John chapter 8. And if I don't have time to cover all of John 9, I definitely don't have time to go back and cover the second half of John chapter 8. However, I want you to know one thing. One thing, at the end of John chapter 8, you find Jesus, and he's teaching in the temple, and he's causing some problems, as he does, and the Jews are getting so upset with him. They're so irritated with Christ that at the very end of John chapter 8, they're trying to kill him. They're trying to stone him. They had had enough. So John 8 ends with really the attempted murder of Jesus. That's where we find ourselves. That's what's happening. And it's as he's leaving the temple. He's leaving the temple, and they're trying to kill him. You know what you and I would do if we're leaving church today and people are trying to kill us? We would sprint out of here. We would get in our cars, and we would go quickly. No delay. We wouldn't look back. But what we're going to find in John 9 is Jesus isn't frantic. He's not fearful. He's not sprinting away as if he's not in control. No, he's in perfect control. He's in authority. He's in charge. There's no panic. He's not hiding. Instead, what is he doing? Exactly what he's supposed to be doing. Exactly what he's supposed to do. We find him calm, not running in terror, but calm. Instead, faithfully moving forward into John chapter 9. So let me read this, just verse 1. It says, Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. So Jesus is passing by. I'm not saying that this is immediately after the end of John 8, but remember, the chapter breaks, they were not in the original text. Those were put in long afterwards. And what is it that Jesus sees as he's passing by? A guy who's blind from birth. Well, if you look into it, you know where the people who were blind would hang out? At the temple doors. They would hang out at the temple doors in hopes that the people going to the temple, coming from the temple, would give them some donations, give them some money, give them some food in order to support their life, right? Here's a blind beggar, very likely sitting outside of the temple. And as Jesus passes by, was this as he's leaving? Like they're trying to kill him 3 steps back. And Jesus passes by and sees this guy, I don't know. But I know for sure that it's not long afterwards. So even if it's a couple days after, that's still impressive. Because if you try to kill me, like, out on that corner, even 2 days later, I'm still going to be kind of freaked out. I'm going to pass by quickly. But that's not what we find here. Jesus is passing by. And he stops. Verse 2. And his disciples asked him, saying, "Rabbi, who sinned? Was it this man or his parents that he was born blind?" And Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but instead that the works of God should be revealed in him." So basically, the disciples see this guy and they want to know, whose fault is it? Whose fault is it that this guy's blind? Was it something he did? Do we blame him? Or was it his parents? Was his parents so sinful, so wrong, that when he was born, this was punishment for their sin? They basically make this assumption, and they want to know, whose fault is it? The guy's life is so messed up, so bad, who can we blame? That was really the only options they saw. It's like, well, if the guy's in suffering, it's got to either be his fault or his parents, one or the other. That's it. And it's not an unreasonable question. It's not an unreasonable question that they asked. I think it's actually appropriate. Sometimes when you're suffering, you know why. Sometimes when you're going through difficulties, you know why. Because you're kind of an idiot and you're making stupid decisions and you should stop it. Sometimes you're suffering and it's because you're in sin and you're rejecting God, you're rejecting the will of Jesus, and God's disciplining you to get you on track. So it's not a bad question to ask. I think it might be appropriate. God, why is this happening? Why is this happening in my life? Is there something that I'm doing that I shouldn't be doing? Is there something that I should be doing that I'm refusing to do? Are you trying to get my attention? So some sufferings in your life are due to your sin, and God is working for your repentance. And there's a lot of examples in the Bible of this. There's a ton of examples, right? You will reap what you sow. That's what the Bible says. If you want a couple of examples, you know where you can start? With Adam and Eve. Suffering enters into the world because of sin. You can make it just a little bit further, not much, a little bit further, and you get Miriam's revolt. Can't get into it, but you know what happens then? They get leprosy. Korah's rebellion, swallowed by the earth. Nadab and Abihu, struck dead. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, it says, "Some of you are sick, and some of you have died because you have partaken of the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner." And lastly, Revelation chapters 2 and 3, Jesus warns that he throws some of you on a sick bed until you repent. So the Bible has a lot of examples, people suffering because of their sin. A lot of examples of punishment and discipline, both because of people's unrepentant sin. But Jesus reminds us that that's not how it always works. He makes it very clear that that's not how it always works. Not all of the difficulties in your life are because of your actions. Not all of the suffering is because of your sin. And of course, he's the prime example of that, right? Jesus, no sin at all, and yet suffered far, far beyond what you and I can imagine. No sin, still suffered. Why? So the works of God could be seen. So the works of God could be done through his life. And that's the case with this man, this blind man. So Jesus makes it clear, no, it wasn't anything he did. It's not his parents and it's not his grandparents. No, it was done so that God's work could be done. God's work could be done. So these people, they seem to have the idea, the disciples of Jesus seem to have the idea that good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. This guy must be bad. Bad stuff's happening. But you know what the problem with that is? The problem with thinking that way is no one's good. No one. If bad things happen to bad people, good things happen to good people, our lives would always and forever only be full of suffering and torment. Romans 3:10, there is none righteous, no, not even one. Isaiah 64:6, even our righteousness, the best that we have is dirty rags. Jesus tells us, Matthew 19, no one is good but God alone. So no one's good. But they seem to think, they seem to have this wrong theology, really. Bad things, bad people. Good things, good people. Heaven's full of good people who did good stuff. Hell is full of bad people who did bad stuff. And in a church like this, we all know that's not true, right? If you pay attention to the Bible, you listen to the teaching, we know it's not true. And yet I think we slip into the same kind of thinking. The same kind of thinking. Their thinking is kind of like the really bad friends that Job had. Listen to this in Job chapter 4, verse 7. It says, consider now, who being innocent has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, those who plow evil and those who sow trouble will reap it. At the breath of God, they perish. At the blast of anger, they are no more. So they say, who is innocent ever suffers? Who ever dies if they're innocent? Well, look forward. New Testament, you know who does? Jesus does. Again, so the works of God could be done. The works of God could be done. So here Jesus says, you know, the suffering that is happening isn't the man's sin, it's not his parents, but God's work could be done. Don't you wish that verse wasn't there? Like, I really wish God could do a great work in my life, through my life, in your life, through this church, without pain, suffering, torment, difficulty. That would be really awesome. But it's not the Bible. Over and over, we are warned, prepared, that suffering will come. Right? In this life, there will be many trials. Jesus says it. But take heart, I have overcome. So God's going to put you in pain. He'll put you in difficult situations to do great work. This guy, the great work, this is a spoiler, but you already heard the passage. What's going to happen? The great work for him was for the suffering, the difficulty, to be miraculously removed. You and I? Probably not. Probably not. What great work might he do in us? Well, he might teach you something. Throw you through some difficulties in order to teach you something. All kinds of problems. Why? So you become patient. So your character is refined. You know what else he might do? He might have you suffer so you're put into the right situation at the right time in order to do the right work. You'd be somewhere where you never would have been if everything went right. I bet we have stories, right? Well, I was going to go do this, then my car wouldn't start, and here I am instead. Well, we planned to do this. God sent some suffering, and look what I was able to do. Look what happened. God will use these works, which is encouraging, right? Because otherwise, this just happens, and it's like, well, life's painful. And there's no good that comes out of it. No, God will use it. James 1, verses 2 to 4, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith will produce perseverance. Right? Here's what I'm talking about. It will build in you the character that God desires to be in your life. The testing of your faith builds, it tests, it refines your character. Romans 5. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character, and character, hope. 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7, trials test the genuineness of our faith, which is far more precious than mere gold, ultimately bringing praise and glory on the day that Jesus Christ is revealed. So if you run from suffering, if you're the kind of person who avoids any suffering, any difficulty, any trials that come your way, guess what? You're going to stay immature, stunted, and pretty useless to God. Right? Because the suffering, the trials, the difficulties prepare you. They teach you. They test you. This week we went on a missions trip. It was hard. There were challenges along the way. Hopefully you're better because of it. That's the goal. That's why we do these things. We're better because of it. God uses it. And it's really tempting to avoid it. Like, no one signs up. Once in a while, we'll have events at church, and there's a sign-up sheet in the back. We should do one sometime, suffering, and see who signs up for it. No one signs up for it. And yet God says it's needed. Instead, we run from it. Biblically, we're supposed to rejoice. Count it all joy. I kind of will put up with it. I'm good at the putting up with it when it comes to suffering. Not quite so good at that counting it all joy. Then beyond that, he'll use it in your life for others. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3 and 4, God comforts us in our tribulations. Why? So that we can comfort others with the same comfort that we received. So you're going through difficulties, you're going through trials, everything's painful, you don't like it. God puts you there. Why? Because you're going to run into someone else, and they are going to need you having gone through that. In Acts chapter 16, verses 25 to 34, that's where you see Paul and Silas, and they're in jail, right? They're in prison. I'm guessing that's some suffering. Guessing that wasn't very comfortable. And what's the end result of that story? The jailer there gets saved. So because they were in prison, they were able to share the gospel with someone who needs it. There they are, right where they need to be. And I bet they wouldn't have signed up for it. So God has a plan in this life, and it will, guaranteed from God, it will include the trials, it will include the pain, and it's not always your fault. Sometimes the suffering is actually proof that God's at work in your life. It's proof. And if you try to avoid it, you'll be fighting against the will of God. Fighting against the will of God. Right? For Christians, we suffer now, but there's glory later. Suffer now, glory later. And notice how these disciples, they look at this guy. They're like, hey, whose fault is it he's blind? They don't say, hey, there's a blind guy. We should go help him. We should go talk to him. We should go see if he needs anything. They say, hey, Jesus, whose fault is it? How often is that us? We see someone who's suffering. We see trials. We see difficulties. We don't want to help him, but we'd like to talk about him. That's what the disciples want. They want to teach themselves. They're like, this is a good opportunity for Jesus to teach us, for us to get what we want. That's their focus. They look at the guy like he's an unsolved riddle, like some trivia. They showed no interest in helping the man, no desire to speak to him, just instead discuss the cause of his condition. Happy to gossip, slow to serve, quick to critique, slow to pray. That was them. That's what they saw. Verse 4, Jesus says, I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. So he sees this guy as well. The disciples see him and have a question. Jesus sees him, and after correcting his followers' kind of wrong thinking, right? No, it's not this guy's fault. It's so the work of God can be done. After that, he immediately says, I have work to do. He's like, I've got work to do, I've got stuff to do, and I need to do it now before it's too late. That's what he means when he says, you know, we got to do it now while it's day because night is coming and you can't work at night. I don't know if you know this, but back when the Bible was written, no LED flashlights. Okay, no headlights on the farming equipment. The work that needed to be done had to be done during the day because night was coming and they could not get it done. That's what he's saying. He's saying there's opportunities before you right now. There are things that God has called you to right now. You can't wait. You can't wait. The idea is hurry up. Hurry up. Right? Time's wasting. Time's wasting. Stop throwing it away. Make the decision now. Stop putting off the commitment. Sometimes in life we get to kind of a turning point. It's turning point. It's time to make the commitment. It's time to make the decision, and we want to put it off. And you know what happens then? You miss the turn. You missed it. It's gone. And to get back to it is going to require some significant backtracking. So are we going to grab these opportunities? Are we actually going to do the work that God has for us, or will we just put it off? Just put it off. Now, I'm trying to guess ages here, how many people I'm older versus younger than. But I remember pastors, even before I came to Believers Church, warning us of the shortness of life. And you know what I did? I just kind of was like, yeah, that's that old guy up there. He keeps telling us that. I'm not that old. And I'm telling you that. Life is short. It goes fast. You know, I'm sitting back there and I'm thinking of the first time I walked into church. It was 14 years ago now. When I talked to Matt, it was 14 years ago. I feel like I got here a couple days ago. It goes fast. It goes fast. And some of you are, you don't care. You're thinking, yeah, there's another old guy. I've become that guy, I guess. But life goes quick. It goes quick. And it's not just me who says this. So if you want to ignore me, fine. But we're going to read some Bible verses, and you don't get to ignore God. I might be wrong. The Bible isn't. So James chapter 1, verse 2 and 4 says, oh, sorry, I got the wrong way. We are going to James, but it's James chapter 4. James chapter 4 says, what is your life? It's a vapor. It appears for a little while, and then it vanishes away. It's like you wake up in the morning, and you look out, there's some fog. It's not there for very long. The sun comes out, it's gone. He says, that's like your life. That's how temporary it is. Psalm chapter 90, verse 10, our days may come to 70 years or maybe 80 if our strength endures, yet the best of them are trouble and sorrow. They quickly pass away and we fly away. Psalm 39, verse 4, Lord, remind me how brief my time on earth will be. Remind me that my days are numbered and how fleeting my life is. It's fleeting. It's gone. It's quick. It's quick. That's why Jesus says he must. Notice the word must. He says, I have to do this. He uses that word on purpose. He doesn't say, well, I would like to, or it'd be a good idea. He says, I need to. It signifies something that is necessary, binding, required. It implies an unavoidable obligation and a divine imperative, a duty that cannot be ignored. That was what Jesus thought when it came to the works he was supposed to do. An unavoidable obligation. Is that what we think of? Not so much. We think, well, does it work for me? Let me check my schedule. Oh, it doesn't work with my schedule. Jesus didn't check his schedule first because he was going to do it. He was going to put God first. He was going to do the works. And aren't we glad that he did? What if Jesus checked his schedule? It's like, oh, the cross? Nah. I got stuff to do. I don't have time. This should lead to urgency. Urgency. So a lot of you have been to the Philippines, and if you don't know, I normally live in the Philippines. In the Philippines, this is no offense, because I bet some of my people from Believer's Church will watch this. I've already told them this in person, but there's not much urgency. They are content to sit in a line at any government office for 8 hours to submit their paperwork. I've joked, and they will agree, that if you get behind two Filipinos talking on a sidewalk, you'll never get anywhere because of the pace that they move. So there's just no urgency. But then let's look here. Okay, we might walk faster, but what are we spending our time doing? What are we actually urgent about? What are we passionate about? What are we moving with fervor and zeal and excitement and commitment towards? This should lead to urgency. C.T. Studd, you guys may have heard of him. He was a wealthy English athlete, and he actually gave away all of his fortune to follow Jesus, and he was driven by a fierce conviction that there was only one life to live, and it was soon going to be passed, and only what was done for Jesus was going to last, right? And that rhymes, so you'll remember it. And he was driven to live his life remembering that, and because of that, this is what he wrote, and this is in the late 1800s, after spending a life serving God in China, India, and deep in the heart of Africa. And he said this: we should go crusading for Christ. We have the men, the means, and the ways. Steam and electricity and iron have leveled the lands and bridged the seas, right? Now they could travel. That's what he's saying. The doors of the world have been opened wide for us by our God. We pray and we preach. We bow the knee. We recite the creed with triumphant. We are optimists, every one of us, and we will shout onward, Christian soldiers marching on to war. And then, And then we whisper, God, I pray you would have me excused. Then he goes on and says, what glorious humbugs we are. You can tell it's a quote because I wouldn't use the word humbugs. He goes on, he says, 500 millions of heathens have not yet been evangelized, yet we have begun to retreat. Meanwhile, in the heart of the world, there are thousands who need the truth that we have. Then the last part of this quote, he says, last June, at the mouth of the Congo, there awaited 1,000 prospectors, traders, merchants, and gold seekers, waiting to rush into these regions as soon as the government would open the door to them, because there was a rumor declared that there was gold. If such men hear so loudly the call of gold and obey it, can it be that the ears of Christ's soldiers are deaf to the call of God and the cries of the dying souls of men? Are gamblers for gold so many and gamblers for God so few? He says, we should be doing this, and we should do it now. We shouldn't wait. God has work for us. And, you know, he's doing this and writing in the realm of missions work. And you might think, oh, there's the missionary trying to tell us we should go overseas. No, I'm telling you, you should go to work tomorrow and you should tell people about Jesus. I'm telling you that you should commit to church with real loyalty and real sacrifice that leads to the mission of God being furthered and advanced. So I don't know what the works are for you, but there are specific works, right? That's what Jesus even says. He says, I have to do the works that God has, not just what he thought was a good idea. We go through life thinking, well, I'm going to do some stuff. I'm going to figure out what I want to do. I'm going to pursue my ideas, my choices. No, Jesus says, I must do the works of God. Of God. We think, well, we'll get to it eventually. We'll commit someday. Someday we'll serve. Someday we'll figure out what's really important. And we put it off. We put it off. We put it off. And you know, the sad thing is, some of you are like, no, I'm committed. Well, maybe you were once, but has that commitment kind of started to drop? Because for some, it does. It does. I would warn you, generally speaking, people don't throw their life away all at once. Generally speaking, people don't throw their life away all at once. You know what they do? Is it kind of leaks away, drop by drop by drop. If I did my math right, average person gets like 40 million seconds in their life. Well, when you have 40 million seconds, you throw a few away here and there and you think nothing of it. Well, yeah, I wasted an hour. It adds up. It adds up, and all of a sudden, the whole life was thrown away. Another quote here, Charles Simon. We are not sent here to eat and to drink and to pass our time in pleasure, but to do the work assigned to us. Every moment of our time is given us for that purpose and should be employed for that end. When we rise in the morning, we should inquire, what duties have I to perform this day? And when we lie down again at night, we should inquire, how far have we executed the will of our heavenly master? Any of you guys ever do that? Like you go to bed and you think, okay, God, did I actually do what it was I was supposed to do today? He says the performance of our work should supersede everything else. Nothing should occupy our mind in the comparison of it. To everyone who would call us from our duty to kind of pull us away from that commitment that we should have, he says we should have the same reply as Nehemiah. This is in Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 3, where he says, I am doing a great work. I am doing a great work, so I cannot come. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you? He's like, I'm doing something important. Nehemiah, he's rebuilding, right? Rebuilding the temple. He's like, I'm doing something important. I'm not coming down to you. I'm not being distracted from the work that God has in order to please you. So Jesus understood that, and that's why he says, I've got work to do, and I need to do it now. I need to do it now. Ephesians 2:10 says that we were made to do those works. We were made. The Creator who made you made you for these works, and I, for one, would like to get them done. I, for one, would like to get them done. In John chapter 4, verse 34, Jesus says that his food, meaning what sustains him, what keeps him going, the driving force in his life, was to do the work, the will of the Father. Is that what keeps us going? Is that what you're excited about? When you wake up and you have stuff to do, what motivates you? Is it to do the work of God, or is it to go to school, go to work, go get breakfast, whatever it might be? Jesus says, what sustains me, what drives me, what makes me move forward in life is to do the work of God. And again, the word is I must. I must. Not when it's convenient, not if it works out. I must. A lot of us, the way we live, says that the mission of God can wait. It says, well, I will eventually, not I must. It should be urgency, excitement, zeal, passion. And if there isn't, maybe you don't know God as well as you think you do. Might be true. So what is that work that he has to do, right? What is the work that Jesus has to do? First of all, I already said it's the work of him who he was sent by. So it wasn't his idea. You don't go through life doing what you want to do. You go through life figuring out what God wants you to do, and you do it. You don't make your own plans as you desire, but you do the specific works that God has for you. And here, Jesus is determined to do it. I wonder if any of us are just content to not even try and figure it out. It's like, I don't even care. I'm not even going to figure out what it is God's called me to. You're not going to figure out what you were created for. Jesus says he needs to be the light of the world. It's like, I'm here, I've got to be the light of the world. That's the work God sent me here to do. Matthew chapter 5, verse 14, Jesus tells us that we too are to be the light of the world. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 8, it says, at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. So we too have been given that assignment. We bring truth. We reveal the truth to the world that doesn't have it. We show God. We expose evil. We bring hope. Everything that is included in that, that's what we're to do. And if we aren't, if our life isn't doing that with passion and excitement and urgency, if instead there's half-hearted commitment, if there's apathy and kind of laziness, if that's your approach in giving light to the world, we're not obeying these verses. And you know what some of us do? We go and we find someone who's shining and we sit next to them. And other people, when they look at us, it's like, I think they're shining. Well, not really. Because if you're in darkness, total darkness, someone's shining a light, someone else stands by them, you kind of look like you're shining light too. Some of us will loosely attach ourselves to others who are shining rather than shining ourselves. If, in case you don't understand what I mean by that, you might come to a church like Believer City Church that's committed, that's passionate, that's excited, and you connect yourself to it, sorta, in hopes of tricking yourself and anyone else that you're shining when you aren't. I wasn't going to make it as clear, but I just thought maybe you would have an excuse to not understand what I meant. That's what it means by connecting yourself to a light, trying to trick people into thinking you're shining when you aren't. Showing up here is not enough. Being a member here is not enough. You can do all of that and still not be doing the works God has for you. Don't be content with that. God's got more. He's got more, and it needs to be done now. It needs to be done now. Don't put it off. Verse 6, when he had said these things, he spat on the ground, and he made clay with the saliva, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said to him, go and wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. So here we see Jesus heal a man in probably the oddest way we ever see it done. In other places, Jesus heals people from blindness by just talking. Like, that'd be way more pleasant. Okay? Like, if I'm ever going to the doctor, if they have the option to heal me with their words or to spit on me, I'm going to choose the words. Little tip for you. If I if I have a choice, I'll go that way. And you know what else? There's other times where he just kind of laid a hand on them and they were healed. Here, he spits in the dirt, makes some mud, rubs it in the guy's eye. You guys ever get something like dirt in your eye? It's not very fun. Like no one does this. It's not enjoyable. It's not a fun process. And yet that's what Jesus does. And the Bible doesn't tell us why. Okay, and the Bible doesn't, the next verses don't say, and here's why Jesus did this, but I'm going to suggest a few reasons that I think are possible. Number one, Jesus has been, if you read back, he's been really declaring himself to be God. He's been declaring himself to be God, and the Jewish people, they didn't like that, and they didn't accept it, and they were rejecting him. And here, Jesus is doing a work with dirt, kind of a work of creation, creating sight, bringing healing to this guy, just like God did at the start. That's one. Another thing is, I don't think Jesus healed the same way every time. You know why? Because if he did, you and I would be trying to do it. Like if every time Jesus healed a blind guy, he spat and made this mud, there'd be all these weird clinic and faith healing centers where people are making mud and rubbing it in people's faces, because that's what we would do. We would think this is the magic formula in order to receive the healing. And then lastly, and perhaps this is the most important for us, I think this was a bit of a test for this man. Because people don't like getting mud rubbed in their face. It would probably be a bit offensive, a little startling, like he can't even see what's going on. It seems, and maybe all the words between Jesus and this man aren't recorded, but it seems like he didn't even introduce himself before he does this, right? Offensive. Someone walks up to you and does that, you won't be very pleased. Someone walks up and does that, you might say, I'm not going to obey you. I'm not going to follow your directions. I'm not going to go to this pool. So is this guy still going to obey? Even though it's offensive, even though it's painful, even though he'd probably rather not. I don't know how far this pool was. I probably could have done some research. But however far it wasn't easy to get to. This guy's blind. He needs help to get there. He can't find it. Is he going to do it anyways? God will do this. He'll do a work in your life, but guess what? It's going to be offensive at times. Guess what? People are going to offend you. They will correct you and you won't like it. There's going to be times where you have to obey even if it doesn't make sense. Like to my record, no one's ever healed this way. If someone did this to me, like if you were sick and someone told you to do this, guess what? You're probably not going to do it because it sounds stupid. Sounds stupid. Well, the guy was desperate. There was no other option. No other option. He actually obeys. When I do this, when I read this, I think of the story of Joshua and Jericho, right? Joshua and the walls of Jericho, and he's going to deliver this city. The city is for them. But how does he do it? He's like, well, here, go and walk in circles and, you know, sing some songs, blow your horns. That's what God told Joshua to have the people do. Imagine you were one of the soldiers, and Joshua comes to you, and he's like, hey, here's our plan. We need to defeat that city. That's the path we're going. God's given it to us. Here's what I'm going to have you do. Go walk in a circle, and then blow your horn. If you're that soldier, what are you doing? No. No. No, thank you. And then do it another day. It's like, well, it didn't work the last day, but you want me to do it another day? Yeah. Do it another day, on and on. Seventh day. Okay, I know it hasn't worked yet, but this time, go seven times more and blow your horns extra loud. Like, you'd run away. You'd say, this is crazy. And as crazy as it seems, I'll tell you that that's what God will do in your life. He'll have you do crazy stuff. And I don't say this as like some prime example, but God told me to move to the other side of the world. Like, I'm just a guy from a really small town in Wisconsin, with very few skills and lots of weaknesses that would make me seem rather unfit for serving as a missionary on the other side of the world. And he told me to do it. It's like, God, I don't get it. But okay, I'll go. He'll do this. Even on the idea of commitment, there's gonna be times where it's like, but this doesn't make sense. I've got other stuff that I should do and I've got all these other interferences. It doesn't matter if it makes sense. Put God first. He knows what he's doing. Don't wait. Don't delay. So this guy was like, you want to rub mud in my face and then send me on a walk? Like, no thanks, I'll just take care of this blindness my own way. That's what I'd be thinking. But as odd as he might have thought that this healing was, as offended and upset he could have been by the methods that Jesus used, he did it. He did it. No sign of complaints, no sign of hesitation. He did it, despite the offense, despite the pain, you know, he's digging gravel out of his eyes. He just obeyed. He had every logical reason not to. And you've got some logical reasons not to do what God's called you to. You're like, yeah, but I gotta put my family first. I gotta finish school. I gotta do all these things. Well, okay. Or maybe just figure out what Jesus has for you to do and do it. Stop making excuses. We think, well, it's gonna interfere. And it will, just so you know. When the call to do the work of God interferes, causes you to say no to a promotion, causes you to change your major, change the direction of your life, causes you to not date this guy or that girl, whatever it might be, will you actually go the way God calls? Who's going to get their way? This guy could have said no. He could have said no. And if he did, you know what would have happened at the end of verse 7? Instead of reading, he went and washed and came back seeing, he'd still be blind. He would still be blind. So you can say no, and guess what? You'll never see what God has for you. You can say no. You can say, no, that's too much. No, that's too offensive. No, I don't like how you're handling this, Jesus. I'm not going to do it. Fine. And you'll never see what God has. You'll never see what he's trying to show you. Right? If the commands of Jesus are too heavy, too costly, too offensive, and you compromise, that's your choice. And you'll miss out. You'll miss out. I think it's crazy how small the healing at the very end is. It's like, and then he came back seeing. It's like, this is a big deal, right? It's a blind guy. Jesus just healed him, and just a passing comment. Well, then he came back seeing. You know why? Because that's just what you should expect, because Jesus can do this. It's like no big deal for him. You obey him, he's got it handled. He's got it handled. Verse 8, therefore, the neighbors and those who previously had seen that he was blind said, is not this the one who sat and begged? Some said, well, this is he, and others said, no, he is like him. And then he says, the blind man says, I am he. Therefore, they said to him, how were your eyes opened? And he answered and said, a man called Jesus made clay, anointed my eyes, and said to me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and I received sight. Then they said to him, where is he? And he says, I do not know. So basically what happens is they see this guy, and they're like, is that the guy? Like, he used to be blind, right? And some are like, it kind of looks like him, but no, it must not be him. It can't possibly be him. And finally, the guy is like, no, it's me. It's me. Yep, I'm him. And people are confused. They're confused. And you know why that is? Because the way the guy was living now, the transformation that had occurred in his life was so dramatic that they're like, it can't possibly be the same guy. Couldn't possibly be the same guy. They didn't even think it was the same person. And that is the work of God. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17, anyone who belongs to Christ is a new creation. The old is gone, the old has passed away, the new has come, right? We have new life, we're born again, we're transformed. Not just kind of cleaned up a little. Born again, new life. The old has passed away. The Bible says we go from an enemy of God to a child of God. We go from blindness to sight. We go from death to life. Totally new. Totally new. Certainly still with sin and struggles, but it should be, as Paul says in Galatians 2:20, that it's no longer us who live, but Christ who lives in us. So at this point, the guy seemed to know really very, very little about Jesus. Very little about Jesus. He didn't seem to know where Jesus was from. I don't know if he even really understood that Jesus was the Messiah, or that Jesus claimed to be God, or that Jesus was the light of the world. I don't know if he really knew who Jesus was or where Jesus was at this point, right? Because they ask him, well, where is he? And he's like, I don't know. I couldn't see him, remember? That was kind of the whole point of this. I didn't see him. The blind man never even saw Jesus until later. We'll see that in next week. And yet Jesus radically changed his life. And that's what happens when you encounter Jesus. He changes everything. If there is no change, maybe we never met him at all. Maybe we never met him at all. And a lot of people claim to be Christians. A lot of people say, oh, I have faith in Jesus. And then you look and it's like, oh, but you're the same guy I used to know. There's no difference. You're living just like everyone else. You're making the same decisions. You're taking the same actions. You're pursuing the same careers, the same everything. And you're telling me that God has transformed you? They couldn't even recognize him. That's how it should be. Recently, we were doing an outreach back in Cebu, and we had one of our students who was not a Christian until they had become part of Street Level, and he got saved. He ran into some old classmates from high school while doing an outreach. And our student is like, hey, would you want to come to our Bible study? And these guys are laughing at him. It's like, what are you talking about the Bible for? Like, you don't believe the Bible, do you? He was so different. They were so confused. They couldn't understand how this man was now involved in Christianity. It made no sense to them. Why? God changed him. God saved him. When we were down in Mississippi, we were talking to a leader of a different campus ministry we got a chance to visit, and he became a Christian, I think, while he was in college, and he was confused because there were all these people around him who said that they were Christians, and he's like, but I'm a Christian, and Jesus is, like, changing everything about my life. How could you possibly be a Christian? And he said all these people around him say that they're believers, and yet the way they were living, he couldn't believe it. He said, no, when I got saved, God's changing everything. That's how it works. That's how it works. And we shouldn't be content with less than that. Jesus transforms people. He brings life. It's a radical change because that's who he is. That's who he is. So we, like this guy, apart from Jesus, are blind beggars. We're desperate. We're in need. We have no hope. Every single one of us. We can't make ourselves see. This guy, just in case you're unaware, it wasn't magic mud. Like, he couldn't have done this himself. He could have spit in the mud and rubbed it in his eye and it wouldn't have worked. No, Jesus had to interfere. Jesus had to interfere. Without a miracle, he was destined to live a life in darkness. Without intervention from outside of himself, he would have sat there his whole life. His whole life. But then Jesus came and everything changed. Everything changed. That's how it's supposed to be. That's how it's supposed to be. And it's supposed to happen now. Not tomorrow. Not next week. We don't put it off because time's passing. It's passing quickly. And there's no do-overs. There's no do-overs at this. We don't get to go back. I think I even shared this with you a couple visits back, but you know, we always talk about there's renewable resources, non-renewable resources. Well, all the non-renewable resources, they keep finding more, and I'm not saying it's unlimited, that's not the point of this, but they keep finding more. But you know what no one ever finds is more time. No one ever is going out for a hike and they look down and say, oh, there's 12 more years, let me grab that. Doesn't happen. Some of us, young, some of us old, I bet every one of us has already wasted some time, but every one of us have already thrown some away. Let's not throw any more, right? The night is coming. Opportunities are passing you by. They won't always be there. There are things available to you right now that even if you stay alive, won't be there forever. There are people in your life that they're not going to be there forever. Some of you are part of Street Level. Guess what? Soon you're going to be old like me and you don't get to go to chemistry class and talk to your friends. That'd be weird. Like, if I just go on campus and sit in class, they're going to think, who's the old guy there? But you can. A lot of people, you know when they figure this out? Average street level people, you know when they figure it out and they really start to live passionately? Like the last semester. Or maybe the year after. Okay? Don't do it. Do it now. Do it now.